Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Rever 97.2 FM, online at radiorever.com, on DAB, on smart speaker, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Eddie Packham and we are mastering the art of outhousery in association with Flowers Unlimited. Well, as we head into the first international break of the season, we can sit back and reflect on our unbeaten start to the season. Saturday's draw at Arsenal has been viewed as controversial by some after Declan Rice picked up a second yellow and saw the Gunners go into their shells for the rest of the game. It was a point, though, that sees us sitting third in the table. After beating Crawley last week, our reward for that was another home tie against Wolves, which is now going to be the Wednesday after the Ipswich game. I think the Ipswich game's next, isn't it? I didn't even check. And since we last spoke, the transfer window has now shut. It was a window that saw us splash out nearly £200 million. And today we will find out how hashtag teams like Brighton can do such a thing and whether we should feel comfortable about it. So who better to join myself and Alan Wares than the man who is the accountant's accountant? He's a pin-up for the spreadsheet nerds. He's a dreamboat for the amortizers. It's only Kieran Maguire. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, chaps. That was a very splendid welcome. I'll check in the post if checks existed anymore.
Well, yeah, I think we've done the Boffin one to death, so I thought I had to come up with something new.
They're getting more and more outlandish every single time. Eventually, you're going to outdo yourself so much, your head will explode.
Well, I think my head's already exploded, actually.
It has. Anyway, Kieran, how are you, mate?
All is tickety-boo, especially in Camp Albion, as far as I'm concerned. So, looking forward to the break. From my point of view, looking forward to a new academic year, which is about to start. So I'm busily updating this, that and the other to try to make sure that people are got a rough understanding as to what's happening in my little world.
I was about to say, so when it comes to your work, for those of you who've just jetted in from Mars, tell us about the position that you hold at, is it John Moores University? And what it is you teach the would-be boffins of the 2030s?
I'm at the University of Liverpool, as opposed to John Moores. We've got three universities in the city of Liverpool. I am an associate professor in football finance, is the somewhat grandeur's title. And I've been there for just over a decade. They sort of headhunted me with the appeal of being able to teach a bit of football finance, and I've taken that on with a lot of abandon, I think it's fair to say. That's practically everything that I do. And as well as teaching two postgraduate courses there, an undergraduate course in relation to football finance, I do sort of general sports finance. I'm doing work for professional cricketers. So I've got effectively the price of cricket going on as a sideline. I've done something similar for the horse racing industry. And I'm teaching for the Professional Footballers Association, including current and former members of the Albion, and the League Managers Association, also including former members of the Albion.
So Kieran, when you first entered into Raw Towers, what 15 years ago, maybe? This was all like none of this had happened yet, and now you're teaching the great and the good, the managers, the ex players, all about this crazy world. I mean, such a thing didn't exist back then, did it?
That's right. I mean, it's become a hurricane, and I'm sort of in the eye of it, in the sense that somebody needs to be able to explain it. There wasn't a book written about football finance, so I wrote one. There wasn't a podcast about football finance, so I got involved. There wasn't a great degree of knowledge about football finance from a governmental point of view, so now I'm involved with government as well in relation to that. So I hate the word expert, because I don't consider myself to be one. I'm just a teacher. I think I'm a good teacher, and that's what I try to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, just to put some meat on the bones there, when you first came on, it was like you said, "Oh, the Albion accounts are coming out. I've had a look at them. Shall we come and talk about it?" And we go, "Yeah, why not?"
Yeah, and now people won't leave you alone. I mean, is it the case of, I mean, because obviously with the Premier League has been around for 30 plus years, and the sort of like the leap in finance that it took, but was there something that was there a red letter day, an event that happened that made, I suppose, what you're doing sustainable?
I guess sort of the first major event was the acquisition of Chelsea by Roman Abramovich. Until 2003, the highest amount of money spent in a season on player acquisitions was £55 million by Leeds United. Yeah, they were the biggest spenders. You know, that's what people forget.
I
And then
remember them.
Abramovich came along, and that £55 million went to 197 in a single season. And everybody started to prick up their ears. The wages of players started to change. And on the back of that, we started to have talk about financial doping coming from the likes of Michel Platini and Arsene Wenger. And with the introduction of financial fair play rules, it from UEFA in 2013, I guess that combined with adding two or three zeros to where football originally was, the rise of TalkSport and Sky Sports as channels that need 24/7 content. And if there's not matches taking place and there's not transfers taking place, sort of 16th or 17th in the list was somebody talking about the finances of the game. And I guess I just happened to be around. As I always say, I'm just a big fish in a very, very small puddle.
But I mean, is it not the case though that I think when, and this is something that AD said at the top of the show about talking about the Albion, when we're talking about expenditure of 200 million on or whatever the figure might be, which I'd imagine probably right now is a bit of a flexible figure. But I think there's probably like us, I mean, AD says, is that a good thing? But then there's going to be fans of so many other clubs that they've seen their team or their club spend embarrassingly huge amounts of money, the sort of stuff that, frankly, the likes of the NHS could really do with, and saving a hospital and keeping beds open and stuff like that. Was that where you became, I suppose, the main talking post, the one person who could actually set everyone at their feet and say, right, okay, well, this is what's happening? Because I know that you've always said, when we started Price of Football, we didn't think anyone would do it. We'll just do half as hours and shows, see how it goes. And of course, it's turned into this huge phenomenon. Did you just really not realise that people were genuinely interested in football finance?
I thought there was a nerd interest for a very, very small element within a football fan base. Football finance has been used as another tool in the tribalization of football fandom, especially online. So if you don't like Manchester City, then the charges against Manchester City become a stick with which to beat Manchester City. If you don't like Chelsea, then the level of expenditure under Abramovich and now Boehly it gives you an accusation, gives you a vehicle through which to accuse the club of trying to buy success. And we did see success in the Premier League when it was initially created by Jack Walker of Blackburn Rovers. And people forget that his was a transformative approach. So yeah, I guess that just happened to be, classic right place at the right time, to sort of as a result of this. I mean, I think last year, and I do actually have a spreadsheet where I list all of my interviews. Last year, I did over 800 media slots, which was tough going at times, I'll be honest.
You could always say no.
I could do, and this is something that my wife always says to me, and then I sort of get into that awkward position. I don't want to appear as arrogant and conceited, and I passionately believe that Scunthorpe and Southend United and Rochdale and Oldham are just as important parts of the football landscape of this country as
Absolutely.
are the behemoths of Manchester United, Liverpool, Chelsea, and City, and so on. So I don't like to say no because I don't want to come across as arrogant.
No, and you make a very, very salient point there, because I mean, to the likes of a lot of shall we say, top six supporters. They don't care about the smaller clubs, but obviously we've been there, done that, and I would still consider ourselves probably, despite the fact the amount of money we've just spent, to be amongst that lot. I mean, I've just come back from holiday, and you know what it's like when you're sat around the pool and you're meeting people from different walks of life and from around the country, you know. And I was meeting people from Barnsley and from Cardiff and from Swansea, and that went down well. And you know, but we're talking about it, and you know, and there was this one guy who called himself a Southern Scouser, which was
The
just
worst name.
absolute. Yeah, I know, I
Are
know. I was.
all your prejudices coming out in one hit now, AD?
Yeah, pretty much. But I had to explain to him, like, explaining to the people, like the Barnsley fan, and to the Welsh guys, and to the guys from Sheffield, what Fans United was. It was a lot easier than to this bloke who called himself a Southern Scouser, who didn't seem to understand the concept of it.
I mean, I think that probably one of the points that AD's sort of nearly reaching for here is do you think that actually that with the point you made just now about the third and fourth tier clubs that you've listed about how important they are to their community, do you feel that being a Brighton fan has given you that extra insight?
Well, I think it's helped to keep myself grounded. And also, a lot of the success of the show, in my opinion, goes down to the fact that I am working with Kevin Day, who I think is an absolutely brilliant presenter, and he enhances the show and has made it, he's made it accessible and understandable in a way which an academic can't do. The fact that he's a Crystal Palace fan, and Crystal Palace have been into administration twice, and he's been through that as well. I think it's given us, I wouldn't say that we're a campaigning show, but we certainly stand up for different stakeholder groups within the industry itself. So we're recording a show tomorrow, with example, from the West Ham supporters group, and it's all to do with the attempt of West Ham and Spurs, and we're seeing it at other clubs as well, to target fan groups who are not contributing enough. You've made your contribution to football historically. Now move on, because we want to replace you with tourists. So I think we are quite passionate in relation to activities such as those. No, it's
Indeed.
not good. Well, I was about to say, I mean, I think when we think tourists at the Amex, for instance, we're the first group that springs to mind is the Japanese, and they do come over in their dozens and their hundreds. I really hope, and I'm not sure that it's necessarily a question, it's more a statement. I really hope that the Albion don't go down that route.
Well, the Albion have got a Japanese Twitter account, and that's the sensible thing to do. There's no point in not engaging. If there's an opportunity to develop a new fan base, and we are Brighton over Albion, and Tony and Paul are sufficiently well grounded themselves to know that these are Mitoma fans. They're not Brighton over Albion fans. But whilst Kaoru Mitoma is at Brighton over Albion, let's embrace them. We've just seen the tour of Japan take place. Why was that the case? It was to appeal to that alternative market.
Absolutely. No, it's, absolutely. But yeah, it's.
I love it. I absolutely love it. I mean, I think that Brighton is such a club that, obviously, I mean, we saw this with Enoch Mwepu as well, where there was an element, you know, the Zambians were really like getting on board with the Albion, but they follow the player and not the club. So if like Carew does go, they will probably go, but I suspect a few will stay. And you know, and I went on that Japanese tour, you know, you're looking at the shirts and stuff, and you're seeing Veltman shirts, and you're seeing Glenn Murray shirts and stuff. It's like, you
We
know, I
are
think that's absolutely wonderful. And come one, come all, really.
making hay while the rising sun shines.
I see what you did there. Okay, well, we're going to talk about the transfer window and our vast expenditure first, but let's rewind to Saturday afternoon, lunchtime kickoff at the Emirates, and we had a lovely time, didn't we, Al?
Oh, we had a gorgeous time. I had lobster thermidor with some eagle fried rice, and I mean, I do enjoy going to the Emirates. Oddly enough, even though, for the fact it's this vast cavernous bowl, they still struggle to make a noise, except when they're cross and entitled.
I disagree, actually. I think, I mean, obviously the Emirates, Kieran, did have this reputation of being the library for quite some time. But as years have gone on, I think particularly over the last couple of years, they found their voice.
I didn't manage to make the match due to some personal issues, but I watched it on television, and I thought the Arsenal crowd were decent, especially after they went down to 10 men, which clearly was the pivotal moment of the match. It was a good game of football. I think we have to accept that if you take a look at the match from Arsenal's perspective, there is the opportunity for season ticket holders to sell their tickets. Now, Brighton at 12:30 on a Saturday isn't particularly appealing if you're an Arsenal fan. So therefore, those tickets go back to the club and then they're resold to, for want of a better phrase, the tourist market. And those people are there to get selfies, to take pictures of the match, to soak in and look around. They won't necessarily make a big contribution themselves in terms of being vocal.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's the issue. So probably across the country, it doesn't matter whether you're Big Six or not. Like for instance, down here, the Japanese might get excited every time Mitoma gets on the ball. Above and beyond that, like you say, they're Mitoma fans. And I'd say probably Brighton to the likes of Arsenal fans, which I think we sort of got to realise at the end of the game. We're not a decent. Well, also, if you excuse the pun, we're not a good draw.
No, we're
Wow.
not. Yeah, we don't put bums on seats.
No.
Yeah, the following day it was Manchester United versus Liverpool, and as a neutral fan, when I'm going through that, shall I or shall I not watch it? It's one of those matches which you tend to watch because it is from two iconic football clubs. It tends to be a bit feisty and spiky, and there's an element of voyeurism, I think, as a fan of other clubs, which you don't get when you're watching. I didn't watch the Newcastle versus Spurs match, for example, before that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the game itself. Then we saw Bart Verbruggen start in goal for the first time this season in the league. Prior to the game, Huerzel said that the rotation of the goalkeepers is now going to stop, and Bart is his number one. Good
I
or
think
bad, Kieran?
effectively, I think effectively that's where we were for the second half of last season. Roberto stopped circulating the keepers. Bart clearly had some form of injury, but he picked up during the summer. And Jason Steele did a fine job. There's no doubting that, but I think for continuity's sake and building up that relationship in the back four, back five, it's useful just to have that muscle memory between the regular players.
And I mean, well, we gave Bart our man of the match at the end. I mean, basically, without him, I think that the scoreline could have been very, very different. I mean, I think some of Arsenal's finishing was pretty woeful at
That's
times,
their problem.
but it was quite often looking at it again now, possibly easier saves than they possibly should have been, but
But the point, sorry,
those
can I?
saves were important and kept us in the games at times.
But the point about it is that I think that as well as Verbruggen did, he was the goalkeeper. He did his job. He saved the shots that he could save, etc., etc. That's not to say that Jason Steele couldn't. And I do wince and cringe at the amount of grief that Jason Steele would get. Now, obviously, once upon a time when he was at Sunderland, he had a horrible time. The films that they made, it showed him up in a bad light. He wasn't popular there. Even these days, Sunderland fans still scratch their head about how Jason Steele is playing in the Premier League. But I think he's a perfectly decent goalkeeper. I mean, people say one's a shot stopper, one's a passer. Well, it's they've both got their positives, and they're both but capable of having a dropsy. They're both capable of having a bad day. They're both capable of having a brilliant day. I know that's not the point you're making, Adi, about Verbruggen being our man of the match. But all I would say is that I wish people would. Yeah, rotating probably isn't a good idea. You do need stability in that defence. But I'm perfectly happy with. If it was Jason Steele that was chosen as number one, I'd still be happy with that.
Here.
Yeah, I do think that the scapegoating, and as an Albion fan of mature years. That's one of the things that's always slightly disappointed me, but I suspect this is a common issue at all clubs.
It is.
I can remember when it was Neil McNabb, when it was Gordon Smith, you know, when it was such and such a player, going through the decades of watching the Albion, and it's always slightly disappointed to me that an element within the fan base seem to take pleasure when players make errors because it reinforces their prejudice against that individual. Whereas for me, even if I think that player X might be better than player Y, I still want player Y to play well because I want Brighton Hove Albion to win. And it's for me, it's all about the team and the collective and putting in a good performance. Nobody sets out to put in a bad performance in football, I can assure you. And certainly, one of the things that I've learned from teaching for the Professional Footballers Association is that you're dealing with human beings. You're dealing with brothers and husbands and boyfriends and sons. And the amount of abuse that players get is completely disproportionate to their contribution to the match. I don't know anybody in any line of life that has not made errors. They are more visible because of the nature of broadcast television, but I've taught players like Phil Jones, and the abuse that Phil Jones used to get was it went beyond. So yeah, it went beyond the red line, and that was coming from Manchester United fans and fans of other clubs. And if I'm honest, I've been guilty of that type of thing myself. You know, taking the mickey out of players. It's one thing which I've stopped doing simply because I see things through a different lens because you get to know people as individuals.
I mean, I am going to remember. I mean, we're talking about scapegoats, and you went back to McNabb and to Smith, and I could think of a few as well.
Ashley
One,
Neal.
yes, who turns up actually quite frequently on YouTube talking about driving now, because he's a driving instructor. But no, the one of those who was it was his turn to be scapegoat for a while was Ashley Barnes. And there was one fella who sat near me, I think it was at the Amex. And Barnes took a penalty. He absolutely leathered it into the top corner. Beautiful finish. Keeper nowhere. Even went the right way. But this bloke, he kicked off like you wouldn't believe. And I said, "Look, what is your problem?" He scored. It was brilliant. He said, "Yeah, but look how close to the post he was. He nearly missed. That's why I'm giving him grief." And you think, I support the same club as you. I'm embarrassed now.
Moving on. Okay, well, the other change to the lineup from the team that beat Man United was that Carlos Baleba came in for the now departed Billy Gilmour. Now, bearing in mind, obviously, we've just spent all this money, we've got all these zillions of new players, and we've got a bit of an injury crisis. I was surprised to see Billy go, to be allowed to leave.
I think you've got to look at the short versus the medium term issues here. Billy Gilmour is a professional footballer. If the club has says, as a result of what happened against Crawley, we now want you to stay until January, he would have done so. But if you look at the comments from Paul Barber, if you look at comments from the coach, they have been it's an opportunity for him to play in a different environment. The fee was acceptable. I think Napoli probably got a bit of a bargain, is in my view.
I think so.
On the basis of what you are benchmarking against, I suspect that Billy Gilmour might have ended up as fourth choice midfield player for the central two positions, as the rest of the season developed. And I think the club was honest enough to admit that themselves, and therefore they sanctioned the deal.
Yeah, Mel.
Yeah, it on the face of it seems strange, and then we're back to the fact that everyone knows how to run a football club, and the club get pelters for it. You know, oh, hang on, we're short of central midfield players, and I'm thinking, are we? I mean, don't get me wrong, James Milner is. I mean, I suppose his knees are the loudest midfielder we've ever had, but the club, and I like to think of this in every case. That, all right, the club isn't necessarily going to get the players that it requires or desires in any given transfer window. But seeing as obviously, and I keep, well, obviously we keep saying this, we're going to go into this in greater depth presently. The club has had its plan. Probably getting rid of Gilmore was not part of it. However, when you see that the plan of what it was for the rest of the squad, and given how things have gone over the last 7 or 8 years, for the most part, I'll trust the administrators at the club rather than some blowhard that sits about three seats away from me who just thinks that everything is going wrong at the Albion.
Well, one thing we noticed early on in the game, Al, was that Arsenal were pretty much targeting Jack Hintlewood.
He's not a left back, is he?
He was having an absolutely torrid time up against Bakary Saka. But we did notice that Hörsler spotted this early doors, and he did make a tactical switch as soon as possible.
Well, this is the strange thing. I think most people in a one-on-one would struggle against Saka, let alone an 18-year-old who's playing in his 27th different position in the same team within the first, what, year or so of making his debut. I mean, the poor bloke is the footballer's equivalent of a pinball. He will play in one position one day. I mean, incidentally, congratulations to him for being called up to England under-21s. Interestingly, as a defender and not in his supposed prime role. But yeah, he's been playing at right back where I really enjoyed him playing there, but left back still seems to be a work in progress for him. So in a one-on-one, in an unfamiliar position against Saka, yes, he's going to struggle. But yes, after about 10, 15 minutes, where Saka was having so much, well, he was having so much fun in the approach play, thankfully not delivering a great deal. I think it's one of those where we got used to get excited about Trossard getting into brilliant positions when he was playing for us and then sticking the ball into Rose Zed when he was crossing it. There wasn't a great deal came from Saka's by way of end product. However, the doubling up, the changing things around, the moving to three at the back, three in midfield, certainly suited Hinshield a lot better. Mitoma was getting back to help a bit more. And I wouldn't say we nullified their threat, but we certainly gave Hinshelwood a bit more support. It's kind of interesting when you see that close up when the likes of you and I sit up in the gods.
Yeah, but it was I mean, the way it was working out, basically they pushed Belabor further forward to stop the ball at source
Yes.
from with from Odegaard, who personally I think Odegaard is just a fabulous footballer, and I just wish he played for us.
Yeah, well, he was their player of the season last year, wasn't he? So.
Yeah, for sure.
The other thing we noticed
But
about it, well, the other thing we noticed about it is, I've got to say this up front, is the terrifying where De Zerbi was doing his terrifying stuff with playing out at the back. We'll get less of that, but we've got the terrifying prospect of playing a high line, or as people of our particular vintage say, the offside trap. It usually worked. But I don't think the linesmen, there aren't any linesmen currently, Kieran, in football that seem to know, who understand the concept of how the offside trap works.
that may be an issue. I think that's harsh on linesmen. I think they've got we have been very successful to date this season in terms of catching opponents offside. I think when it moved to some point in the second half when the offside trap was organised in such a way that Jean-Paul Van Hecke was 70 yards away from Bart Verbruggen as the closest link. I thought this was great. This is Brighton Hove Albion with 10 players camped, not even in the other opposing half, but in the opposing last third of the pitch,
Yeah.
with a desire to try to win a match. And I think that is one of the takeaways that we have seen from the early games under Fabian, in the sense that if you look at the substitutions against Manchester United, it wasn't holding on to a point. It was let's go for three. And I think that it will be a common feature, which will work sometimes and will not work on others. And God bless him, I say. I think it's exciting times ahead.
What Al was actually alluding to there, Kieran, was that the way that football is run now with the linesmen is their reluctance to put their flag up, even if it's a blatant offside. And we did actually see an incident in one of the first games of the season with a Nottingham Forest player breaking his leg, when he was clearly offside, going for a ball which he wouldn't have gone for if the flag had gone up when it should have done. And we saw this happen time and time again. And it's, the players technically, like I said, that they should know if they're offside or not, but they should be playing to the whistle. And we saw a few instances where it just didn't happen, and it was just blatantly off.
It's just, I think it's just the nature of the press box where we were. We had a good sort of view of it. We were probably good 10, 15 yards inside, certainly in the first half, so inside our own half. So we could get the, you know, that's about the line that, the Albion were playing. And so, of course, when you've got sort of 5 yards either side of that, then you've got a really good view. And I still say, and I don't think anyone has looked at it, I'm still convinced there was an offside early in not Spurs, Arsenal's goal.
In the first phase, yeah.
Yeah, when the ball got booted up in the air, and I think Lewis Dunk made a complete pig's ear of it, which was not clever in its own right. And yes, Boyle may point fingers at him, but I think when the ball was booted in the air in the first place, Saka was in an offside position. But I don't think anyone's looked at it. There's no point in howling about it because otherwise it makes me sound like an Arsenal fan who's moaning about Declan Rice's red card. And we wouldn't want that on this show, would
Yes, we would. Let's talk about
we?
Declan Rice's red card. And I mean, there was an argument that the first yellow could have seen the foul
Yellow
under
was
seen them
correct. I
given.
think yellow was correct.
Yeah, I think it probably
It
was.
was there was no studs. He did have his feet sort of turned in a way that, I mean, if his feet were turning, the studs were showing, then that's a different story. But yeah, no, yellow was correct. I mean, it was,
Yeah.
you could see him going for the ball. He was just late, couldn't pull out, you know, foul, yellow card, get on with it.
Yeah. But the second one, Kieran.
It's a yellow card.
Course it is. I'm
Had it
baffled as
been
to how it's being debated.
the other way around, we would have moaned about it. But the player himself has admitted that I kicked the ball away. In order to avoid this, all that Declan Rice had to do was not kick the ball away. In relation to the whataboutery,
It's a lot of it.
if we start off with the João Pedro issue, could the referee have given a yellow card for that? Yes, he could. Would we have complained? Probably not. It was done out of frustration, but Arsenal weren't attempting to take a throw-in. It wasn't a case of slowing the game down. But I don't think there would have been much grumbling coming from us.
Yeah.
And when Arteta starts talking about consistency, well, I'm more than happy to put on my financial hat and say let's have consistency in terms of the total wage bills of all the clubs in the Premier League and the total transfer spend. And you know, if you want more consistency in football, Mikel, I've got a spreadsheet that shows you the reaction and the results if you take that approach.
Well, this is, I mean, there's several parts of it. And I think actually watching the Sky Sports clip of Dermot Gallagher, I don't think he's the most comfortable chap on telly in the first place.
Yeah.
But the disdain with which he dismissed Arsenal's Grisling was actually quite funny. I mean, because there was obviously, yes, he flicked the ball away. Ah, but giving a red card for that. Well, he didn't. He gave a yellow card. It just so
Exactly.
happened to be the second one. Ah, but Veltman whacked him. Because when we were in the press box and we saw, all I saw was Veltman whacking him. I didn't, obviously didn't see the little flick of the, and I thought, my first thought was, he's caught him, he's whacked him, that's a red card. But then you see why he did that. But the ball was moving. Well, one, Joel Veltman's got a habit, and I mean an ongoing habit. I don't know if anyone else has ever noticed, of taking free kicks when the ball is moving. And the number of times the referee has to call it back and say, no, take it again, the ball's moving. So the whole thing of the ball moving is not a defence, or is not a piece of mitigation against what happened. And then, yeah, but he can't take a free kick if the ball's moving. Well, in that case, then you don't need to worry about João Pedro whacking the ball away because it was moving then as well.
Good point.
You know, so where is the argument? And the argument is it's an England player at a top six club. First red card, like I say, he's if he's professional enough to not acknowledge that he's been stupid enough, then who is anyone else, you know, certainly his own fans, to say this is an outrage? But
Arteta was outraged in the presser afterwards. It was most enjoyable, but it's amazing, amazing, amazing.
yeah, amazing that the referee should apply the laws of the game correctly.
But I mean, just to play devil's advocate on this a little bit. I mean,
No.
was there a bit of outhousery from Joel here?
But there was an element of that in the first yellow card. Joel did go down quite spectacularly, and certainly it was a foul. Yes, Given that Neil Maupay is no longer at the club, the role of chief mischief maker
Yeah.
has very much gone to Joel Veltman, and I think he's a master of it. You've only got to see his closeness to Raya in the first half in some
Yeah.
of the corners that are being taken,
Oh,
and
yes.
that is part of the game. The only sad thing for me is that I'm a huge admirer of Declan Rice as a human being. Everything I hear from the football industry, from journalists, and so on, paints him in such a positive light. And I think it was just unfortunate that he now has a red card, as red cards are part of football. He's a really good guy. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. Even though he abandoned
I think
Ireland.
the Arsenal outrage was largely not necessarily because it was the wrong decision. It was the wrong player. If it was I don't know, like Saliba or someone, or who said the Ukrainian guy,
Zinchenko.
Zinchenko, if it was him, that was now missing the North London derby, I think there might have been less outrage. But speaking of outrage, Al, you were a little bit outraged at certain elements in this game, where I think it was two bookings we got for the same reason, which was waving an imaginary
Oh,
card.
certainly I saw Minte do it. I couldn't be sure about one of the other ones. I certainly saw Mitoma doing it last season, season before, something like that.
Yeah, he got booked for that as well.
You just don't do it. I made sort of just as a passing comment on social media before, come on guys, don't do it. And I've been told to wind my neck in, and I've got Albion fans encouraging those players to do it because they could and should, because they've got to tell the referee how to do his job. And you think, actually, what you're doing now is you're actively encouraging players to get yellow cards for petulance. You don't do it. It is a rule that that's correct, not always apply, but then, like I say, the referee hasn't got 50 pairs of eyes. To be fair, I didn't see him do it. But the referee was straight there. I think it was at the same time that an Arsenal player got booked. So the decision was correct. But like I say, when he's going to then turn round and wave the yellow card, imaginary yellow card, you're going to get done. Tough.
Yeah. Okay, well, we saw not necessarily the best of Lewis Dunk for the Arsenal opener, but we saw one of his absolute pinger of a passes for our equaliser, which sent Minte through on goal. And well, he missed, but Pedro was there to pick up the crumbs and finish with
Some plums.
aplomb.
There's two things
And it
I
was
want to ask say about this, Kieran. One, Lewis Dunk, dear God, is any good at picking a pass? Two, what a crap save from Raya.
I'd agree with you on the first issue. I think Lewis Dunk has become a fa fantastic quarterback in terms of his long ball distribution. I don't know whether you saw the data which comes from the not the or the other 14 Twitter account.
Oh, yeah,
John
another
Paul
one, yeah.
Van Hecke, seven long balls, seven accurate long balls. He was the only person to do 100%, but Lewis did very well as well with regard to it. I think that's another facet of the game. I'm not so sure with Raya. Minte was not that far out when he shot. Could he have tried to push it sideways? Possibly, but it was very rushed. And
Yeah.
I think, again, a positive feature of the Albion is that, this is not a criticism of the way that the club played under Chris Hughton. We used to have one person going up front for those
Yeah.
type of balls, and now we hunt in packs. And we, as a result of that, we
Yeah.
reap rewards.
I would go further than that, Kieran. I would say that David Raya is a terrible goalkeeper. I don't know why they thought that he was an upgrade on Ramsdale, but he is a dropsy. He spills everything, and it's like, just shoot him and he'll parry it. Just make sure you're following up. That's all I'm going to
Well,
say.
this is it. A decent goalkeeper making a decent save, you'd like to think. And I do think of the likes of, say, for instance, I know it's in the Championship, but I like to think of the likes of David Stockdale knew how to do that. Even Sanchez, you know, and all right, he's getting criticism mostly because he's at Chelsea, but he was a decent keeper for us. He would know how to do that. You know, our keepers know how to do that, but there have been Albion keepers who save back into the penalty area. And yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that Jack Stern is not teaching his goalkeepers that kind of thing anytime soon.
Okay, I mean, it was. We'll finish up on the game in a second, but I mean, it was like the title challenges did go into defensive mode. I mean, they did have a couple of chances where they should have probably got themselves ahead again, and Bart was equal to it as they hit us on the counter. But you know, Iari had a chance as well, and he probably should have scored. But the fact that Raya was booked in the last minute for time wasting for the title challenges at home against Brighton speaks volumes.
Well, they actually was about 20 minutes out that they started doing that. Taking ages over a throw-in, you know, Raya taking ages over a goal kick. Yeah, hoping that, you know, quite rightly that they pick us off. And actually, to pick up a point that Kieran said earlier about sort of, I say, effectively defending on their 18-yard line, it can leave you undone. And there was a couple of times where the back four was about 10 yards inside the Arsenal half. And all you have to do is have one Arsenal player on the halfway line or 1 yard inside it. He's therefore got a 9-yard head start. So you have to be a wee bit careful because he's not going to be offside.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, you're listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, which is available wherever you get your podcasts. We are brought to you in association with the brilliant Flowers Unlimited, which is ironic, seeing as we have a chairman called Bloom. Where is Flowers Unlimited, Alan?
It's in Portland Road. I think they're still digging it up. But yeah, do go along, pop along and see them for all your floral needs, of which everyone will have them at some point. I know I did about 6 weeks ago, which was nice. If you go in there and you do need your flowers, just point out that you're an Albion fan and they'll give you a 20% discount. They are very friendly, very helpful. We had a genuinely lovely time, you know, with dealing with them. And it's a pleasure to have them on board. So yeah, Flowers Unlimited, Portland Road, Hove.
Now, Kieran, do you enjoy a little bit of window shopping?
I met my wife.
I'm here all week trying to fish.
Could possibly come in. So Kieran, obviously the headline news here is obviously the figures that we've spent, and the question is, obviously this is very much out of character for the Albion. So I mean, obviously Tony Bloom's done the official Albion podcast today, and he's explained an awful lot of it, but I mean, should we be concerned about us spending this sort of money?
Not in the least, because I think what you should be doing when you're assessing any business is you look at it over a long period of time. Over the course of the last 3 years, Brighton, Hove, Albion have probably spent about £5 million more than they generated from player sales. And over a three-year period, that's effectively, you know, a non-issue. I think the club moves when it considers to be appropriate. The club has taken advantage of opportunities which wouldn't necessarily have arisen this very often. So in the case of Minté, Newcastle United had to sell by the 30th of June. He was on our radar by all accounts 12 months ago before he went to Newcastle United. And he took the opportunity to go there, but they needed money. We've got money. Let's take advantage. In the case of Rutter, he had a clause expiring at midnight. So the Albion, and this is, I think, his textbook Tony Bloom, they put in an offer at 11:45, which means that they can't be gazumped by anybody else. Yeah. Triggers the clause, so, and everything works.
The question about that is, Kieran, now, obviously, I mean, you know a little bit about contracts and contract law and stuff. How would we know about that clause?
Well, ultimately, it's a private contract between two individuals. Sometimes things leak. And it could be that the club has leaked it. It could be that somebody close to the player has leaked it. Football is a very insular, incestuous industry. And, you know, you as, you know, now members of the Fourth Estate, you get access to stories and information which you can't say on this show. I do similar from my side of sort of the outer Hebrides of the football industry, but journalists will give me bits and pieces and so on, and the stories come through. As we're recording this on Wednesday evening, a story has just broken that Leicester City have managed to avoid a charge in relation to their finances, and I've had three journalists call me in the last 6 minutes to try to explain it. So, stories will come out.
So with all that's being done, and I guess that with the club never disclosing either sales or purchase prices, and whatever those prices actually mean, because who gets what, what part of it goes to here, there, or everywhere. I mean, is there anything that's listed within the accounts that I want to ask a follow-up in a second, but is there anything listed in the accounts that actually then zeroes in on a given transfer when you actually get to look at the books?
No, all that you see is the collective sales income from player sales, the collective profit and the collective investment in terms of new recruits. And then there are complications because there are add-on fees here and there and so on. So trying to get things identified on a granular level is a shame in my view. If you take a look at the accounts of a club such as Juventus, which I do, then they go through every single transfer and they list how much has been spent in respect of individual players, both coming and going, the other parties to those contracts, and so on. I absolutely understand the Albion's approach. We've got to be smarter rather than bigger, so let's keep it coy. And we've got an owner who is a professional poker player in as part of his canon of skill sets, and as a poker player, you don't give anything away unless somebody pays you for the privilege. So I understand where the club's coming from, and I understand why other clubs take a similar approach. It's frustrating for us as fans because we're nosy, and that's what it comes down to. We're nosy.
But in as much as we're nosy, is there any advantage that you as a an economics teacher can actually then say if you did find out, like I say, the line by line ins and outs like Juventus offer?
It helps me in terms of some of the calculations when you're trying to project figures going forwards. But if I'm honest, the only time I would use those is if it was part of a takeover deal and you're acting probably for the buying side. So that would allow you and you would gain access to that. There's something called a data room, in an M&A deal for a football club. If you are a serious buyer, you pay a fee to the club for access to the full books, and that allows you to get a feel for what you're acquiring, what you're not acquiring, the ongoing, the future costs, and that would help you to put forward a price for a potential purchase of the
Yeah,
club.
but
Sorry,
in
AD,
regards to
sorry.
AD, can I just say, just as a footnote, that M&A is mergers and acquisitions, just for those who speak non-Kieran.
But I was just going to say, Kieran, I mean, in regards to the Juventus books, is that an Italian thing, or is that just because they have to be a little bit more transparent because of their previous misnomers?
Well, I mean that they are listed on the Italian Stock Exchange, so there are greater demands put on you if you are a listed company, and we see that in the case of Manchester United here in the UK. Manchester United are listed on the New York Stock Exchange. They have to publish accounts 4 times a year, as opposed to clubs such as the Albion, who are private companies and they publish 1 time a year. Italian clubs tend to be a bit more open in general, and that does allow you to get a feel for where the money has gone. We're all in this conversation old enough to remember that period of time before the word undisclosed ever entered the lexicon of football conversation. It's a relatively new item.
Yeah, but that's like the things that have exited the lexicon, like month-long loan and
Yes. It would have been handy to have, until such time as few players are ready, it would have been handy to have had Gilmore back for a month. But sorry, getting back to what we've done here. Now, I think that obviously with with who we are and what we feel about the Albion is that I think that there's a side of us that wants to be the perennial underdogs, or at least be seen as the perennial underdogs. And I take your point you made earlier about how finances can be used as a stick by some fans to beat others with. But here we are now spending figures, or at least headline figures, that are in comparison to, or in fact in excess of, sort of nearly every other club. But this is not being done without a plan. I mean, basically, in short, we can afford this, yeah?
Oh, certainly. The receipts from Caicedo, Cucurella, Ben White, Trossard, Mopay, Dan Burn, £22 million for Graham Potter. Yeah, all of that has put money into an area of the club which it can choose to spend if it so desires. And I think the advantage of being a club such as the Albion is that there is no expectation, there is no pressure. If you take a look at the reaction of Spurs fans, Spurs spent more than £100 million, Newcastle United fans, some Liverpool fans as well, to the lack of spending of the club. I personally find it baffling. You know, I've always taken the view, only spend if you think you can improve. And looking at the nature of the acquisitions that's been made by the Albion, it's clear that that's been their approach as well.
Well,
Yeah.
that was my point about the nature of the acquisitions here is that, as you're pointing out, we're making hay while the sun shines. You know, we've had the £120 million profit from last year. I think you said on this show that there's going to be a nice, you know, a nice war chest by the time the figures for the end of June 2024 come out. And obviously the club know this and therefore know what they can spend and what they can't spend. So knowing that war chest, it's something that the club has never had. But the nature of the acquisitions says also to me that the club is not that confident. Not to say it's not that confident. These things don't come along that often. So therefore, we have actually acquired, in theory, a young squad for the next 3 or 4 years rather than one that's trying to make a push this year or next year, Kieran. I mean, is that the, you know, looking at who we bought, is that how you see it, or is there something else to it?
Yeah, if I was a master poker player, I would know when to go all in. And I think we've got somebody that knows a wee bit more about poker than any of
Yeah.
us on this conversation.
So
If you take a look at the
is this
age of
us
those
going all in
guys,
then, Kieran?
well, we will not see this level of expenditure next summer, I can
No,
assure
no.
you of that. And you know, my view is João Pedro's made a good start to the season. If he has a full season, remember he was out for 3 months last year. If he continues the level of form that he's shown at the start of the season, he's then 2 years into a 5-year contract. He's 22 years old. The club bought him for 30 million. They'd be looking to sell him for 70 to 80. If you take a look at the other players who have been recruited, they are all young players with a capacity to deliver. And if they deliver based on the expectations of the work that's been done into researching their abilities, then it's not money being spent, it's money being invested. And there is a difference. If you sign a 28-year player, 8-year-old player for 60 or £70 million on a 5-year contract, that's money being spent. This is investment. There's going to be a return on that investment in due course.
That's what
So
this feels like, yeah.
this isn't just us like just spending money on young players the way we have done. These are box fresh players. These are players that are ready to go now, which is something which we haven't done. And they're ready to go straight into the first team once they're fit.
But those who we did acquire in the last 18 months, 2 years, and I know that you're a bit disappointed that Buonanotti, for instance, has gone out on loan. Valentin Barco has gone out on loan. But frankly, had it not been for so many injuries that we'd had over the last sort of 12 months or so, they'd have probably gone on loan as soon as they'd have come in anyway. So I don't think this should be sort of seen as a negative. I think this is just something that arguably should have happened a while ago. But the point I was going to come back to Kieran about was, does it therefore come across that with the tidbits that we had in May, with seeing as what the Albion have done over the summer, compared to something else that evidently Roberto Di Zerbi wanted, we've actually just gone and done it now. And if Di Zerbi had had his way, we'd have probably seen a whole, probably the same amount spent, but on different players, do you think?
I agree entirely. You've only got to look at the players that Roberto was associated with, such as, is it Mahoud, Dahoud? I always forget his name slightly. He was that 26, 27-year-old player with experience that Roberto was looking for. The club is now no longer, as you, I think you rightly observed, Al, it's no longer acquiring players for very modest fees with a view to these are going to have to be cooked for the next 12 to 18 months, probably not at the Albion. And now they're looking in that sort of that 20 to 30 million pound bracket where they can come and make an impact straight away.
I would argue with that slightly, actually, because I mean, knowing the way that we do business, the club works several windows in advance. For instance, they were looking at Minto a couple of years ago before he went to Newcastle. They've been looking at Vifa for a couple of years, and actually, in his interview with Glenn Murray and Paul Hayward on the official Albion pod, Vifa did actually say that he'd already been speaking to Roberto. So that's with that in mind. I mean, I suspect that Roberto was probably sitting in his office in Marseille, thinking, "Flipping heck, they just spent nearly 200 million quid. Why didn't I get that money?"
No, but
But
that's.
a lot of this stuff, he would have known about prior, and because you know, I'm guessing he would have been involved in the conversations when we're talking about the transfer
This is the
window.
point we're making. If there was supposedly, let's throw this figure out there, the one that's, and I'll come to Kieran to see if we can get something more accurate, but let's suppose in this 200 million that you reckon you mentioned at the top of the show, AD, you know, the club has gone through the, you know, what it went through in the summer and acquired dot, 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 this player, that player, this player, that. These are the ones they've got. I think the point we're making here is that if De Zerbi had stuck around and got his way, we'd have had different players. Maybe, you know, Weaver might still have come along. Maybe some others might still have come along because they were attractive to him. But those which De Zerbi wanted and those which follow this algorithm, this kind of magic formula, this kind of mystical box of tricks and numbers and equations that says, right, this player's right for us and this player isn't. You know, that's what we end up with. And I think that it sounds, I wouldn't say the club's necessarily going to follow it slavishly. There's got to be some give and take, but for all the players we've acquired over the last, say, 3 years, we've certainly had more hits than misses. But getting back to you, Kieran, is there anything that you can add to that says that puts some meat on the bone as to how much well, the spend has been and what the net spend has been?
Well, the spend is somewhere in the 190 million. It's been 190 and 196, is my understanding. You know, there's exchange rate issues. There's, you know, is certain money going to agents? Will that be included? And so we'll find out in due course in relation to that. I don't think that Tony Bloom's contribution, you know, certainly can never be underestimated, but it is part of a much broader issue. The club does have a very good policy, I think, in terms of character identification, and that's been finessed. You know, it wasn't that long ago that we were recruiting, you know, Ali Yahan Bash and Jürgen Lokadia, and you know, those presumably came from the advice given by Star Lizard as well, and fair to say that they were not spectacular successes. So we're in a rich vein of form when it comes to recruitment at present. Long may that continue, but when I talk to data analysts in football, the one thing that they say is we've all got the same information. It's all out there, and we've all got the same spreadsheets. It's understanding how the bits fit together that's critical, and I think this is where the Albion do have not an advantage, but they are competitive to the best of clubs.
For now, that's all we've got time for. So thank you, of course, to Kieran Maguire. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been AD Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with Flowers Unlimited. But thanks for that. We'll see you again soon. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Cry the long night through. Well, you can cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. Being so untrue, well, you can cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you. You drove me, nearly drove me out of my head. While you never shed a tear, I remember all that you said. Told me love was too plebeian. Told me you were through with me. And now you say you love me. Just to prove you do, come on and cry me a river, cry me a river. I cried a river over you.